All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucksters? What the fuckadelics? I'm Mark Maron. This is WTF. This is my podcast. Welcome to the show. How's it going? Everybody doing all right post Father's Day? Did you call the old man? If he's alive, did you call him? Did you bury the hatchet for 15 minutes? I did. I called my dad, and it was okay. It was pretty good. He was in a pretty good space. By the way, Neil Young is on the show today. I should tell you that right now. It was a pretty exciting day. It was a very nervous day for me. You know, Neil's one of those guys, man. He was a giant. He walked the earth when giants walked the earth, and he's still a giant, but he's an older giant. But he's Neil Young, and I was a little nervous. I'll tell you about it in a second. I'll tell you more about that in a second, but I want to stay in this dad thing while I've got the emotions that are still kind of hot. I am recording this in the afternoon on Father's Day, and I had done something. I'd done something a couple of weeks ago. It wasn't even a couple of weeks ago. My dad wrote me an email that was a fairly concerned but overly wrought, somewhat paranoid, and projecting email in response to the tragedies of the last couple of weeks, the shootings and whatnot. I guess it was concerned, but for some reason I misread it as a kind of feeding on sadness and negative energy and projecting it onto me. And I just reacted. I was feeling horrible that day like everybody else. And I just shot back at him. And I reacted in anger. I sent him some shitty emails. And then a few days went by and I just couldn't live with it. And I felt bad. And I apologized. I emailed an apology and he said, thank you. I love you. And I'm all right. A lot of times when we get caught up in our own bullshit with our parents, they cease to have a life outside of that. They, you know, I don't know how empathetic I am with my father or my mother on a day-to-day basis because is that my job? I mean, it's hard to be empathetic to your parents' situation sometimes, or maybe that's just me. And sometimes it's hard for me to acknowledge, you know, that my father may have been out in the world doing good things or having an impact on other people's lives in a positive way. And because you get so caught up with your own relationship. So out of nowhere, I get this email. The subject line is Father's Day. And it just says, Mark, I'm not certain this email will ever get to you, but I've been wanting to send a few sentiments your way. And as we are coming up on Father's Day, I thought it especially appropriate to do so. Some 18 years ago, my son, Nathaniel, broke his leg in a high school football game in Western New York. He was taken by ambulance to a nearby hospital in some forsaken little backwoods town. It became quickly evident that his injury was more severe than initially thought. In fact, he suffered from what is termed compartment syndrome, which often results in the loss of the limb because the swelling constricts the blood flow and amputation is often the only way to save a life. We had this doctor appear who was sarcastic, sardonic, funny, and absolutely wonderful. Without going into unnecessary details, his actions saved my son's leg and maybe his life. Now, 18 years later, my son is 36 and has just become a father for the second time this past week. After a very long recovery, he completed college, started a very rewarding career, and has become, most importantly, a wonderful father and husband. As you probably know, that doctor who saved my son was your father. I never assume anything about anyone else's relationships. Life is far too complicated to think that my experience mirrors anyone else's, but I wanted you to know that your father's actions on behalf of my son helped to turn what could have been a tragic situation into something very positive. I am aware, through the power of Google, that your dad has ended his career in what appears to be a rather sour situation. I feel badly for that. All I know is that your dad did all he could to help my son during a critical situation, and without his help, I'm not sure my son's life would have worked out the same. I would appreciate you letting him know that we think the world of Dr. Marin, and we are fortunate that fate had us cross paths with him in that Warsaw hospital that fall football Saturday. Finally, I do want you to know that I remember Dr. Marin mentioning to me that his son worked in comedy and thought it took exceptional courage to enter that line of work. When I first saw you perform on TV, I immediately made the connection. I'm not sure if you are a father or not, Mark, but as a dad, I know your father made a difference to my family, and I will never forget that. Thanks, Paul. In Knesset, New York. Well, thank you, Paul. Because sometimes, you know, I forget that my dad did good things, and it's good to hear that. And as I get older and I get more emotional about things and a little more willing to let things go, that email choked me up. It choked me up again here. And I do want to send some love out to all the fathers that are truly doing the best they can. And that might not be enough for a while. At some point, it's going to come back and bite you in the ass. I'm not a father, but I knew that I bit my father in the ass. And I continue to occasionally. When I called up to wish him a happy Father's Day, and we talked a little bit about the series of emails I sent that were, nothing short of just snotty, abusive, fucking angry child crap. I told him, I said, I don't know, it was a hard day, it was a bad day, and I lashed out. He goes, yeah, that's what I thought. I go, yeah, I imagine you would think that because you do that too, and we're both crazy. And he laughed, and I told him I loved him, and I hope he had a good day. Here's the deal with Neil. I love Neil Young, and there's about 10 or so records of his that I just, they're fucking amazing. And he's done a lot more records. He's done, like 50 records, a lot of records. Neil Young, the amazing thing about Neil Young is that it never really gets old. It always is very transcendent. He's a true genius of the song. And he's a kind of an intimidating character. And I know he's not easy necessarily to talk to. I didn't know how it was going to go, but it was one of those days where, Neil Young's coming over to the house. I'm going to do the best I can. I'm excited to meet him. I just didn't know if he was going to like me, which, I don't know how long you've been listening to this show, but that it's better if they like me. And I didn't know how it would go. And I was nervous. And he came over and he had a little posse of 70-year-old dudes or so, a little white-haired posse, his manager, Elliot, and a couple other cats. And it was one of those times where, this happens very rarely, but it happens where, Neil walks in, looks at my living room, sees my Gibson 335, walks right over to it, picks it up, sits on the couch, fucks around with the guitar a little bit, looks at my stereo system, sees my records. He's saying, like, nice guitar. And and on the table, his new Pono Music system, the little box that you can listen to Pono with, is sitting there. And I had it all packed up to give it back to the guy because they told me I had to return it. And I told him, I said, well, you guys can take that, I guess. And Neil said, no, let him keep it, man. I like him. Let him keep it. That's what he said before we walked out to the garage. Let him keep the Pono. I like this guy. And I'm like, okay, that's a good sign. That's a good sign. But his new album, Earth, comes out on Friday, and you can get that wherever you get music. But you can also, get it in that high-resolution audio through the Pono Music Store. You can also get it on Tidal. But the Pono is pretty fascinating. It's a pretty amazing thing. And the new record's pretty interesting. There's a lot of things going on. I'll talk to him about it. So enjoy this conversation that I had with Neil.
Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago.
Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF.
Young.
You want to wear cans or no?
I'll try it.
How's that?
Well, it's my changed my whole personality.
You're a different guy now.
I am.
It was that easy.
Know, I did a show once where the DJ was talking to me.
Yeah.
And we were doing, I was doing this show. This is like in the 60s or something. And he's talking to me, you know, and the show hasn't started yet.
Yeah.
And then just as it starts, he puts on his phones.
Yeah.
And his voice changed completely.
Yeah.
And I said to him, right away, I said, you're like a completely different person when you put on those phones. It doesn't even sound like the guy I was talking to a minute ago.
It's true, right?
Yeah. But that blew his mind that I said that on the air.
And he quit?
He quit right there. He left.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, he did. And then Elliot and I were the only ones in the studio. We just played records for about 45 minutes till somebody else showed up.
Is that true?
Us. Yeah.
So the guy freaked out.
Yeah, he freaked out and left.
It was in the 60s?
Yeah.
So he was probably high, and
He wasn't ready. It was right. It was me at some point in time where that was, you know, it made him feel, you know, anyway.
You tapped right in, you saw his soul, and he ran out. Last day of work for that guy. So, but the experience with the Pono, like, we might as well start with that, because I had an interesting thing happen. You know, to interview somebody like you, I freak out for about a day or two and before it, only because, you know, you have such a massive amount of productive work out there in the world. So I'm loading my head. And I thought it was interesting today and within the last 2 days, so many new things happened that would never have happened. I don't know how much time you spend on the computer, but like just because of the world we live in, you know, like for instance, like I listened to Expecting to Fly for the first time this morning. And I'm a Neil Young fan, but I didn't know that song. I didn't have that in my head.
That's an early.
Right, it's Buffalo Springfield. And I listened to the Pono, to the new record, for the first time all the way through last night. So I got bookends.
Yeah.
The experience, both of them slightly psychedelic experiences.
Yeah, Jack Nietzsche and I made Expecting to Fly that took like about 30 days for us to complete it with Bruce Botnick, the engineer. We had a fantastic time. A lot of time mixing it with these old two boards and everything.
Yeah, yeah. So Jack Nietzsche did a couple Stone songs. He did Spectre stuff.
You can't always get what you want.
That's Nietzsche.
Yeah.
Now, wait, when you do something like that, when you work with a guy like that, how clear is that memory for you now?
Very clear.
Yeah?
It's as clear as you right there.
That's it.
He's right here.
Yeah. And when you were setting out to do that, because you were creating a new sound, what was the collaboration like? How do you start to go to that place?
Well, you know, I was very young.
Yeah.
And I think it was like was only the second Buffalo Springfield album,
yeah.
I think,
yeah.
that Expecting to Fly was on. And, you know, he had just started talking to me about doing things myself and being, you know, a solo artist. So, you know, I just
listened to him.
He's like a mentor.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
He's a genius guy.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you knew that going in.
He did incredible. Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I knew everything he'd done, all of his
yeah, yeah.
charts that he'd written for various things, Spectres and stuff that were just insane charts.
Crazy. Yeah, that whole crew back then was like nuts.
Yeah, well, he was the architect behind
the Wall of Sound's
parts.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Putting all the Wrecking Crew together?
Well, I guess, probably Spectre got the musicians and Jack, and then... But Jack wrote down all that stuff, and then I think it was Jack who said, well, we should have three guitarists playing the same thing instead of one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then it's, you can hardly hear it on the record, but it's three of them, and it's just this massive wall. I mean, it's true.
This is a sonic blast.
Yeah, mono.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Mono kind of flattens things. Like, it's interesting that the difference... Mono's actually better, because it all's coming at you in the same time.
Mono is the ultimate.
Why is that?
Well, because it's deep.
Yeah.
Stereo's distractingly wide.
Right.
And because of that, you don't focus on the depth.
Right.
It's a little bit false, stereo.
Right. Because, like, when you listen to mono on the good system, you know, like, it just floats in the middle.
Yeah. And if you are listening in any room, your stereo is your own ears bouncing off of the walls. But it's on one source, like, you know.
Yeah. And the other thing I was doing when I knew I was going to talk to you is I started sort of compressing people in mind. The other thing I listened to Burt Jansch for the first time
this morning. Isn't he great?
It's great.
Yes.
And it's an amazing world we live in that I can just discover that. Because a kid who I know, Matt Sweeney from Superwolf, he says, you listen to Burt Jansch. So I listen to Burt Jansch. And then I start thinking about you as a kid in Canada. I start thinking about Burt Jansch. I'm thinking about Link Wray. And I'm thinking about Roy Orbison. I'm trying to put my head together, wrap my head around, you know, what galvanized your head. Do you have an idea of that?
Well, those guys are pretty popular.
Yeah.
You know, when Link Wray and Roy Orbison, all those people. I mean, that was great. It was great music.
Yeah.
You could really hear it and feel it.
And Link was just broke. That guitar sound was insane. Just broken up, man. Yeah. Did you love that?
Yeah.
Yeah. And Roy.
Rumble,
right?
Yeah.
And then Orbison kind of had that sort of heartbroken, ethereal. That
falsetto. But what a great range. Oh, my God.
Amazing. Right? And where'd you grow up?
All over Canada.
In Winnipeg a lot?
Winnipeg, Toronto, Omimi, Jackson's Point.
Do you spend a lot of time up there still?
No, not as much as I used to. I don't know what the future holds, though.
Oh, yeah? In terms of...
Canada's a cool place.
It is, man.
Cool. Yeah.
I've done some time in Winnipeg. Winnipeg's very flat. It's intense.
Yes, it is.
It's a little harsh.
It's in the middle of everything that's missing.
Yeah. It seems a little beaten up.
It's got a lot of soul.
It does,
man. It does have a lot of soul.
And when you started, playing guitar, what was it, who was around? I mean, what were the bands that you were, playing with, and local guys, Canadian guys?
Randy Bachman.
You like that guy, right?
Randy is cool.
Guess who?
Yeah.
Bachman Turner Overdrive.
It was called Alan and the Silvertones. They were called when we first listened.
And he was always a pretty monster guitar player?
Monster, exactly. Had his own sound, had a thing going on, had a tape deck up there, and he had tape repeat coming off the tape deck.
Back then?
Yeah, back then, live on stage. Just incredible sounding.
So he was he's sort of a wizard up there.
Yeah.
And he was just a kid.
Yeah, he was just a young guy like me, a couple of years older.
And did you you have, how many brothers and sisters you got?
One brother, two, and one sister.
Yeah, and you just grew up, why'd you move around so much?
Well, my dad moved around a lot.
Yeah.
Really a lot, because he was a writer and he just kept moving. And then when my mom and dad broke up, I moved again with my mom.
Yeah.
And that was Winnipeg, and then I started the band and started playing.
How old were you when that happened?
13 or 14.
Oh, yeah? But you stayed in touch with your old man, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What kind of writer?
Everything. Sports, human interest, fiction.
Did it inspire you?
He wrote hockey books about hockey players in high school and stuff. It was pretty cool.
Were you a sports guy?
No.
Not at all, right?
No. I mean,
either it clicks in or it doesn't, right?
It didn't click in for me.
No, me neither. I don't know what the hell anyone's talking about.
There's enough of them doing it already, though.
They don't need us.
No, they don't need us.
So
you got to go where you're needed.
That's right.
That's it.
They don't need me at the arena. They seem all filled up with guys who are painting their face funny colors. I'm good. But music was it then?
Oh, it was for me, yeah.
And what was the first rig you got?
For my guitar?
Yeah, yeah.
I had a Harmony Sovereign.
Was that a hollow body?
It was a hollow body. Well, it was a Monterey.
Mm-hmm.
Harmony Monterey, I think it was.
Yeah.
And it was like a flat. It was what do you call it? An F-hole guitar.
Right.
And I had a sliding D'Armond pickup on a thing that
on
I could
track.
Slide back and forth
right,
on a
yeah.
track.
Yeah,
know?
Yeah.
And I plugged it into our Seabreeze stereo system.
It just blew out those speakers.
It was pretty harsh. It distorted quite a lot.
Of course. It was like that was the
a
beginning
little mismatch.
Of And who were you like playing along with at that time? Where were you learning?
Oh, I didn't really play along with things.
Yeah.
But I really listened a lot to there was a couple of key things. Hideaway.
Oh yeah.
It was a cool track.
The Freddie King?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I really got into Jimmy Reed.
Oh yeah,
that's who I really liked.
Yeah, he leaves that open on when you go the turnaround.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. I talked to Keith Richards about him. I've talked to a couple people about him.
Yeah,
about
him.
Jimmy Reed.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, sweet voice and that great guitar sound,
amazing.
Harmonica.
Yeah, and you couldn't really tell who was playing what on those records. Either,
right. Yeah.
Know?
Yeah. Like yeah.
Because Buddy Taylor.
Uh huh.
Is the guitar player on those records?
Oh really?
So I don't know if he's the one. One of them's playing
right.
like that.
Yeah.
And the other one's, you know.
Doing the licks.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that
funky
drive. Yeah,
but
yeah.
But that was usually three guitars. It was three guitars, one of them tuned down, playing the bass.
So no bass.
One of them, I think, I don't know whether Jimmy was playing the treble guitar or playing the boogie guitar.
Right. Yeah,
and
no one
there
knows
was an upbeat too that happened. If you listen to it, there's three guitar players,
and I think his wife used to sit there in the room with him too.
Yeah, you could hear her singing just before him,
right?
So he get the words.
She had to prime him, right?
Yeah.
I think it was some issue with his sight. I can't remember.
They worked really well together. It was a beautiful thing.
Yeah. So when did you meet Stills? When did Springfield start? How did that happen? Do you mind going through this stuff?
Jesus.
Are you guys okay?
No, it must be. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you guys are good?
Oh, we're great.
I never know how well you guys are getting along.
No, I'm getting along great.
Oh, good.
No, I don't have any enemies.
Oh, that's good.
That I know of.
Yeah. We all want to assume you guys get along okay. You know?
I think you should assume anything you want to assume. Because that's what I'm doing, you know.
Like I would,
it works.
You know, I like. There's a. You know, I kind of like. I come into this, you know, not being quite as old as you, but you know, like revering certain people and certain groups of people. And like in my mind, it's hard when people fight. But
yeah,
I, you
well,
know,
that's
you guys
never
have,
fun.
You guys have lives.
That's not fun.
I mean, you have relationships with these guys for what, 50 years?
Yeah, kind of. Well, Stills is longer than that.
Oh yeah,
Stills goes back to like I think it's 63 or 64. I'm not sure.
When you were kids.
Years. Yeah, I guess we were kids.
And you met before Springfield, right?
Oh, yeah.
And
at least a year before Springfield started.
And were you guys playing together then?
A little bit, yeah.
You just kind of hanging around?
Yeah.
What do you got?
Well, fun.
Yeah.
Admiration for each other is what we were doing. He sang so great.
Great voice.
Wonderful.
Yeah. You guys have such different perfect voices.
Well, they've been described in different ways. I know that Stills' voice is a great voice.
Right. Crosby, too, right?
Yeah, he's a great singer.
Yeah, and it's weird because his voice, it doesn't seem to ever change. Like all you guys, I don't know how'd you keep your chords so nice, man? Is that you on top of that?
You might have to check yourself out now.
Oh, really?
I don't know if your analysis of the situation is accurate.
No, yeah, I hear this record. You sound good. What do you have to? Is there things you have to do to take care of that thing, or do you think about it?
Nope.
Just let it go.
I think it's about, you know, being healthy.
Yeah.
Try to be in good shape. Stay strong.
Yeah. That just happens naturally.
Well, you got to work at it, but it happens.
What do you
naturally
do? What do you do to take care of yourself?
Well, you know, like this morning, I got up and I walked. I walked on the beach for 3 miles.
Oh, yeah?
And I, you know, a lot of times, like 5 times a week, I have Pilates.
Do you?
Yeah, I do.
You
it's
get
the best
up?
Thing I ever did.
Do you get on the machine or just do the laying flat?
I do all the thing, whatever they say.
Tightens you up?
It's great. It makes you feel your body.
The
and
core.
Your body starts to move and you can use it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really good for you.
And you do,
I enjoyed it.
You have
anyway.
A trainer that does it, comes
there's
in?
There's several of them. I mean, I just keep coming.
And you
and
got off the booze
great.
Too, huh?
Booze?
Yeah.
No, I still drink when I feel okay. like it.
Oh, good, good.
Everything in moderation, you know, even moderation should be taken in moderation.
How long did you take to figure out the moderation trick?
I still haven't got it yet. I don't have it.
All right.
How about you? I think you're doing okay.
I'm off. I don't do nothing.
What about coffee?
Coffee. A lot of coffee. and I do these nicotine lozenges.
Oh, what do they do?
They're basically nicotine candy.
Oh, so instead of smoking, you do that to stop smoking?
I don't know. Like, I think that might have been the intention, but then I just decided, well, these are pretty good.
Do they get you a little bit jacked?
Yeah. They do the same thing as nicotine does. You know, if you hit it just right, you're not jacked. If you go too much, you're down.
No, and you're in trouble, but it doesn't hurt your lungs.
No. It does nothing to your lungs. I don't know what it's doing to the other organs.
How many of these do you take a day?
I don't keep track.
How many packages do you go through?
Well, no, these will last me a couple weeks. I get three tubes.
Well, that's
tubes.
Good.
You
get three tubes and it'll last you a couple of weeks.
But no one has told me that they're bad for me.
No. Wait a minute. How many are in each tube?
24 and I split
them.
I break them in half. So I got 52 doses in each 48. In each
48,
one.
And there's three of them.
That's
150 approximately.
No, I break one in half, and then I do it. And then, you know, I sit here.
So that's 150 halves.
Something like that,
Approximately 142
right,
or something.
Right.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, I just
three
write
weeks,
it up.
Let's see, 3 weeks.
Yeah.
I get mathy. If I go into a certain place, I have to do the math.
You break it down?
Yeah, I don't stop till I'm finished.
You got to ride the equation all the
you
way
gotta
through.
You got to go all the way. But I think we can drop that one. You know.
All right.
People that were interested, they can figure out where we were going.
Sure, sure. I'll get tweets, people going like, I know the number. Why don't you talk about other things? What are you talking about math with Neil Young for?
Right. Well, you know.
So, do you have a place down here?
Yeah.
In LA?
Down here, yeah.
Oh, you live permanently down here?
Yeah, I do.
But you still have the ranch, right?
No.
Oh, it's gone?
No, it's still there. I'm not there.
Oh, when did that happen?
A couple of years ago.
Do you miss it?
No, I really don't. I was there for a long time, and it was great. It was always a wonderful, beautiful place.
Yeah.
But the planet is so huge, and there's so many beautiful places. You really deprive yourself if you stick yourself in one place and go, this is mine. I have to stay here and take care of it.
Right.
No, there's more to it than that, I think.
So where are you? So you're down here like up by the beach then?
No.
You're around.
I'm around.
I get it.
I'm in the hills.
Okay. Like back the hills. In the hills.
Yeah.
You've returned. You've come full circle.
Yes, I have.
So when you did the, it's hard to do like obviously a whole history, but I like to get a sense of like when you first came to Los Angeles, you know, well, that was in the late 60s, right?
66, April Fool's Day.
And that was with Springfield?
No, that was before Springfield.
Oh, yeah?
I was with Bruce Palmer, the bass player in the Minor Birds.
Rick James's band?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When we broke up and Ricky went to jail and, you know, we broke up. And then Bruce and I decided to take a shot at L.A. to see if we could get a band going down here.
So that was R&B that you were playing
at the time? A little bit of that, yeah. Sort of kind of funky thing. But we had a little bit of Stones, Rolling Stones. We played a few of those songs. And I was writing a little with Ricky, and you know, and so was one of the other guys in the band was writing too. So we had a good time. Great band, really good band.
And then that's when you moved down to Topanga, or that was later.
That was later. We moved right down here. I think we came right to Silver Lake.
Oh, what was that like then?
It was different, but it was the same.
Yeah, still pretty.
It's a great place.
It is a great place.
Yeah.
And what was the scene like? I mean, what was it? How competitive were you? What were you looking to do?
No, just start a band and write songs and play songs. You know, I'm not a rock star thing. I'm not so sure about that.
But you just wanted to play music.
Well, hell yeah. We wanted to be in the best band in the world, you know, to get something going.
Yeah, and who were the people that you were meeting at that time?
We were looking for Stills.
Yeah, and you knew he was down here?
Yeah, I knew.
We got to track him down.
Yeah.
And you found him?
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, and then that became Buffalo Springfield. Yeah,
he found us, actually. We were leaving. We were going to San Francisco in the hearse that I had. And we were heading out of town. I had Ontario plates. And when you saw me, when we met a couple of years before, I had a hearse with Ontario Plates. It was a different one.
Yeah.
But he just, you know, you don't see that often.
No, not the
And so they caught up with me.
Yeah.
There were a couple of guys in the car.
They actually tracked you down in the car?
Yeah, they stopped us right on Sunset.
How many leisure hearses are there with Canadian plates?
That's got to be... It's got to be a rare item.
Yeah, it's got to be new in that car.
That's right.
So he tracks you down, and then you guys, you start Buffalo Springfield.
Yep.
And then you knock out a couple of great records.
Yeah.
And then you meet Jack Nishi, and you start thinking about solo.
Yeah, I know. I think I'd dropped out of the band already once.
Yeah.
And that's when Jack and I started hanging out. Then I went back with the band for a while until finally the band kind of broke up.
How does that happen with bands? Is it an aggressive thing, or is it just sort of a go your own way thing?
Yeah, you know, I was like 20 something years old, a very young guy. I had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah.
I can't be responsible for that.
Well, No one was blaming you.
No, but I just did what I felt like doing, you know.
Right. And at that time, did you find that, is it usually a musical issue? Like, you know, I want to go this way. You guys want to go that way?
No, not at all. I just think that it was one of the things that I didn't like, and we got into quite a deal about, was the, a Johnny Carson show.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Shows like that.
Right. They wanted to do them?
Yeah, and I didn't really like that. I didn't like playing on TV and...
Did they make you lip sync?
I didn't like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, at first we did. We did a couple like that. And finally...
Fuck it.
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Wait, was it just the expectation or the showbiz element or the selling element? Or what is it just exactly about that?
All of those.
Yeah. It's
all what made you mention above? Those three things?
Yeah, because that's something that you've kept with you. That is something that, you know, that belief system is...
You know,
in
I
place.
Always feel better when I don't do that.
When you don't feel like you're, you know,
I just don't want
pitching and hustling.
I really don't like, you know, I don't know. I'd rather play for people live
in
a place that was for music.
Yeah.
Where you could really play loud.
Right.
And there wasn't people in front of you. And
Right, moving around going, can we stop? Can we stop? Can we stop the song?
Yeah.
And I think back then a lot of them lip synced, didn't they? I mean, it was...
Yeah, No, they got lip sync copies of me doing things.
Is it?
Yeah.
How do you feel about those in retrospect? Are you sad that they're out there?
Well, they're funny.
You get a kick out of them?
They're very funny. I don't know who that guy is, but he was okay.
Yeah. But that idea of you know, having a space where music is supposed to be played, and, you know, I only can relate to it similarly in stand up that, you know, there's places where stand up's not supposed to be done. You know, you do it where you're supposed to do it, where it's best received, where it's control of the environment.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, there's all these different interesting, you know, sort of, you know, waves of what you're doing. And like, you know, I was, when I first listened to the new one with the mixes, you got a live concert and then you integrate these animal noises. And at first I'm like, wait, what's happening? But then, like, it sort of started to, you know, level out. And, you know, and I was surprised that initially I thought, well, is this going to be hokey? But then I was sort of like, no, this makes complete sense. That, you know, like, the bees, when it's sad that when you hear bees, you know, on either side of an anti-Monsanto song, it's sort of heartbreaking.
Well, you realize, you know, we lost 30% of the bees last Christmas, or last winter. 30% decline in bee population here. And bees really hold everything together, you know. They're very important.
So in conceiving a record like that, which I guess, you know, would be something experimental, I mean, was this, whose idea? What's the think on that?
It just was no think. It was just, I had a meeting with my co-producer, John Hanlon, who's my engineer.
Yeah.
Who recorded a lot of the stuff. And I said, listen, I just want to do an album. It's going to be a studio album. We're going to be full on in production, which I haven't done in years and years and years. I haven't made a real record in many years. I've only made records of performances of things in the studio, whatever.
Yeah.
But this is a real record where anything we want to do, we can do. We can do anything. Nothing is too cheap for us. We will do anything. And there can't be rules about, oh, it's a live recording, so you want to do this, you want to be honest about
it. Right.
No.
Yeah.
So we started like that, and then we put the songs together, and they started talking to me like, these songs, I can hear animals, and I can hear things in the audience.
Yeah.
And I could hear it. I've heard it before, you know. I've heard these sounds before.
Yeah.
Just in my head, listening to live tapes that I've made over the years. And I go, God, that sounds like a dog barking in the background, or it sounds like, you know, wolves or something.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's actually people yelping and carrying on.
Right, right, right.
So I added those in just to see what would happen, and I went, wow, I really like that. It's like they're all here.
Yeah, yeah.
So I created this picture. It's an audio. It's an ear movie.
Yeah, right.
It's an ear movie. You close your eyes, and you can go away for 98 minutes. It never stops.
Right. It's something's continuous.
It's
not music, there's the sounds of audience integrated with animals. And it's all, and also you had the freedom of this new bandwidth, this new file, this new range was part of the impulse for this, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, we created the work that we created, we captured at its highest level, the way it was in the 60s and 70s and early 80s and the 50s even. That kind of audiophile quality that everyone heard.
Right.
That's the way we recorded it. And that's, so we were able to capture the whole thing. And the only thing that we did that we couldn't do then was, it's long and it's like a movie, but you don't have to stop.
Yeah.
You know, on the master file, you listen all the way through. And the CD has got only one break. I mean, there's two discs and it stops in one place and you got to put it on the other disc.
Right. And isn't the idea of the Pono, though, to sort of engage the depth of that sound that we...
The idea of Pono is to give you exactly what was created.
Yeah.
Without putting anybody's intellectual property device on, like MP3.
Right, or
the new MP3, whatever it is.
Yeah.
That encoding. High-res
compression,
files.
Right.
Yeah. Encoding and compression, we don't have any of that.
Yeah.
And we just have a excellent playback system. In the player.
Yeah.
You can listen to it on other players, but our player was voted best in the world by Stereophile.
Yeah, I like
it. So we got a great sounding player, and it's made by a genius guy who really hears, and, you know, we found him, and he made the player for us, and it's so great.
Long time in the making,
this thing. Yeah, yeah. So it all sounds really good. If you really like good, pure files of the music you love, whether it's old or new, that's what we sell at PonoMusic.com.
And what about this? The band, The Promise of the Real. There's a new band for you, right? The last
They're
few
great.
Years.
Yeah.
And those Willie Nelson's kids are in that one?
Yeah, a couple of them are in there.
Yeah.
So the pedigree of the band is really great, and everybody's sensitive to the music. They respect it. It's been their whole life.
Are there any old guys?
Serious,
or are you the only
just
guy?
Me.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, I feel really good in there. I feel like... safe and also no fear.
Yeah.
And they have no fear.
Yeah.
That's the key ingredient in love.
Yeah.
No fear.
Well, that was the interesting thing in the movie, not in the movie, so now you got me calling it a movie.
Well, you know, it is a movie. If you close your eyes, you went to a lot of places.
I did go to
remember Bram Stoker's Dracula? Did you ever see that one?
With the Coppola film?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Remember when the bat was flying down the street? And it was like some old...
Yeah.
And you saw like it was the image of what the bat was seeing.
Yeah, yeah,
of course,
yeah.
The bat can't see.
Right, right.
But that was what was interesting.
Right,
so that was the impetus for doing this record. Because you're hearing things and you can't see them. And you're going from place to place. I mean, you're playing all over the world. I mean, you're going to the bottom of the ocean, downtown New York. You're going out in prairies. You're
brooks. Yes,
you're in barnyards. You're everywhere.
Right.
You go everywhere around Earth
during
the record, and the music is like a break from the traveling.
Right.
And so you just get meditative kind of in there.
It's trippy, man.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
It's far out.
Yeah, man. but the interesting thing is, like, fearlessness is the core of love.
Yeah.
Being open. And, like, there's two songs on there. The hippie song, The Hippie Dream, which is sort of like, you know, drawing a line between the hippies that are still fighting and the hippies that have given up in a way or surrendered to comfort or whatever it is that they surrender to.
Right.
But the dream of you know, change and love is still real and still something that has to be fought for. So that's one of those Neil Young songs where you're sort of like, you know... You fuckers quit, right?
Somebody did.
But not you.
Apparently not.
Right. And then there's the idea that, you know, this idea that that love, like the, because like there's something about that hippie ideal that was a fashion that, that you know, because there's another song on there that, that is basically a somewhat of a direct or satiric attack on people that just want music about love.
Yeah.
And here we're saying that love is really what can conquer and what can win, fearlessness, and that's a love that's got a little fight to it, yet the sort of trite love of love songs, or generally, I imagine you're talking about pop music in
a
way.
You know, I'm just talking about people who don't want to hear a confrontational message. They don't want to hear no fear.
Yeah.
They don't want to hear about certain things.
Yeah.
They just want to hear about love. That's what they want to hear about. That'll relax them because pretty soon, you know, like they really need to get away. I mean, you know, that's they put on the radio. They don't need to be attacked.
Right, right.
So they're feeling that way because the rest of the world is not really, you know, maybe they don't feel great about the world. So they want to get out of the world and just go to music.
And escape.
But, you know, unfortunately, living in that musical space is people like me. I mean, I'm there, and there's a lot of people like me that want to sing about things that, that they care about. And so the song started from you know, I was playing my songs from about anti-corporate songs and all these things. And somebody just, you know, I got the message, you know.
Yeah.
Like, people want to hear about love. That's what they want to hear. You know, I'm going, well, I don't give a, you know, I care. You know, I sang about love already.
Yeah,
you know, only love can break your heart.
Yeah.
You know, I sang about all the many aspects of love. And quite recently, I did an album called Storytone.
Yeah.
That's all about love.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was only a couple albums ago. And I'm going, what does this mean that I have to only do that?
Right.
And you know, I can't talk about things like, you know, the dangers of different things and incongruous
mutant
things that are
seeds,
happening.
War.
Yeah,
pollution.
Pollution, corruption.
Oil mining.
Corporate government.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. No,
those things. I think they're interesting.
But you still have people that have those that confront you with that stuff. Like they that come up to you and go like, "Where's the old Neil?" It's like,
yeah,
which
right.
one are you talking about?
Yeah, really? Where's the old Neil? But that's one of the things about this record that'll let when they go to Earth and they want to take that trip through there.
Yeah.
The oldest song on there is 45 years old.
From which one?
After the Gold Rush.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So. Even in the middle of that song, even though it's a live version but it's live in a different way, it's a living version.
Right.
It has the original French horn that was on the real record from 19.
You pulled
whatever.
It from the tape.
I took the whole master and I just dropped it into this live one.
Uh-huh.
It's just seamless and covered it with a few things so that people could feel the space and traveling and. Because that's what the whole record's about. So that's a little disorienting when you hear that and you hear these beautiful voices, the corporate harmony singing along with After the Gold Rush. It's like there's something a little edgy about it in a way that it's so sweet.
Well, right.
It's just so nice. But it's
not.
Wait a minute.
It's underneath there. Yeah. That's some Neil Young shit in there.
So what is that?
The corporate harmony, the vanilla corporate harmony.
Yeah, the vanilla singer is a corporate harmony.
So, but obviously talented and sound great, but there's
fantastic.
But there is a joke to it.
Well, you know, there's just I motivated them and I said, listen, you really got to sell this.
Yeah,
this is great stuff.
Right.
You know, this. You know, you got to think how cool some of these things are that you're. You know, like. How optimistic you should sound when you sing Exxon. You know,
right,
it's really great stuff.
Yeah.
It's energy. It's
but you're
people need it. You have to have this. I mean, you know, here we are.
You directed them.
Yeah. Sell these concepts. You know, Monsanto. It's a beautiful sounding name.
Right. So
make it sound like a beautiful day. I mean,
make
it sound.
Right.
You know, so I.
It's a satirical device done beautifully.
Well, they're great commercial background and commercial jingle singers, the best in L.A.
Oh, that's who you got?
Yeah. They're the best ones. I mean, you know, I know there's other ones that are really good, but these ones we got are you know, the best that we could get together right there.
And I love it.
They're really excellent. So they sing so perfectly and so in tune, and they're obviously so much more accomplished technicians.
Yeah. So the idea was to play them against the message of truth.
Well, you know, the idea was that they played against the promise of the real.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in the image of the record. They're there on stage with us, and we're playing, and the animals are cheering. And
yeah.
Every once in a while, the animals come on stage and do a breakdown where there's just the bass and drums and animals.
Yeah.
You know, so it's like, and they're good with the band. They're always right there, you know. Yeah. They never miss.
Right.
So, and they just show up when they want to. But floating in among all of the image of the band on stage and the animals in the audience and sometimes on stage is this hologram of these vocalists.
Yeah.
And they're perfect. And they're just so great.
So this is a very, this is, it's almost like, you know, everything that you've sort of been working towards and playing with, you know, coming together in one big fucking mix.
It kind of is.
Yeah. And I like when you were talking about the French horn, there's when you say traveling, there's a time travel element that the one thing that music affords you outside of any messaging is a really the only time travel machine that we really have.
It's
that's
really
reliable.
It's a good one.
Yeah. And like and that's what's curious to me about this relationship, which is probably the longest in your life, you have with that guitar.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Right. But like, you know, like, you know, I can tell, I'm projecting it onto you, but you respect, you know, the history of things, and you understand the magic of things, and also the depth of what an object that makes music can do, right? Because that organ, what is that organ on that record?
On Mother Earth, the organ is, it's a pipe, a pump organ.
An old one?
Yeah, you got it in a junk shop.
And what's that, but you've used other organs that are like old-timey ones, right?
Mm-hmm. But that one was, that's as old as.
Yeah.
I used an organ on Country Girl, and I've Been Waiting for You also a long time ago, but that was from... That was in Glendale, a huge organ in a church building.
You went and you recorded there?
Yeah, recorded it there, yeah. But this one is just a pump organ that I can play and sing at.
Uh-huh.
So that was live. We did that way.
But the guitar, what is it, when you, because that guitar has gone through a lot of shit.
Yeah, well, yes. It has.
And what, you play a few guitars, but you're not a guy that's got 90, are you?
Well, I got a lot of guitars, but I just get guitars because I like them, usually for writing.
Right, but when you go on stage, it's only a couple, right?
Yeah, I play two or three on stage.
You play that big Gretsch?
Yeah, sometimes I'll play that.
And that black Les Paul. What is the story on that Les Paul, man?
I got that guitar from Jimmy Messina.
Uh-huh.
He traded. I think it was a trade.
Yeah.
Something to do with... I'm not sure. I think it was a trade. It's kind of hazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I got that from him, and
it was a gold top that someone had shellacked with black paint.
It was black, and it had a lot of finished ivory put around it, and all kinds of stuff, and it was half fallen off, and there was still a couple of pieces of it left.
Yeah, and did you just maintain it?
No,
just let
it be what it was.
Yeah.
I mean, Larry Craig, my guitar tech, maintained it for me, and still does. I mean, he does the real lion's share of the work on it.
But going back a little further into the time travel thing, that thing you did with Jack down in Nashville in the Storytone album.
Yeah, yeah.
In the machine. That's literally a time travel machine.
Oh, that voiceograph. Yeah, that was, what's that called? That album was called A Letter Home.
Oh, yeah,
Home. Yeah, and that's, that was a voiceograph. Yeah.
And you just did that because you thought it would be interesting to do it in the voiceograph?
Yes.
Yeah. It was kind of, and it was all covers.
Yeah.
Some of them by guys you knew.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to make a record that sounded as old as the songs that I was singing.
Yeah. And
it really does sound like they were, you know, in some cases you listen to it and go, wow, maybe that's like from before when the record came out. You know, it's so old sounding. So it's unique in that respect. I thought it was a very, very rewarding project.
And you did two Gordon Lightfoot songs?
Yeah.
Did you know him coming up?
Yeah, I met him a few times. Yeah,
he's really, Canadian, right?
He's a real good guy, yeah.
Yeah, he wrote some good songs, huh?
He's written some great songs. You know, Dylan thinks he's one of the very best ever.
So when you were, like, you know, when you starting, because there seems to me to be something that, you know, like, here, this is how I work, because I heard about your issue with Setlist. This is what it looks like of what I wanted to talk to you about. It's a fucking mess of words that I'm going to come at it like a collage. Like I wrote here, just I wrote the sadness and anger that floats eternal. And like, because there's a quality to your music that it doesn't ever date itself, Neil. Like, it's better than time travel, because if you put on most of your records, you know, outside of, you know, some production elements later, but there's no time to it. It's timeless. Do you feel that?
Well, I just, I try to be really into it.
Right.
While I'm doing it, and, you know, then let that all happen, you know, whatever it is. I don't think about it that way. I'd really think about each day and each performance and each song as a unique thing, and that's where I put my energy.
Right. What's your writing process?
There isn't one.
It just comes to you sometimes?
Yeah, sometimes I just get it. I'll put down anything to finish a song or to do something if I have an idea.
Yeah.
Whatever I'm doing will be second. So I always have learned that if you're going to do something, you know, and you have a musical gift, it's like you have to accept the gift. It's not like if I'm sitting there thinking of what I'm going to do, I'm fucked.
Yeah.
Okay, that's not it.
Right, right.
That's not it. You know, if you get something that comes to you, that's it. Grab it. Don't do anything else. Whatever you're doing, stop and go and follow whatever that idea is.
Yeah.
And that's how I write.
Something that connects with your music is very heavy-hearted.
You know, yeah, but I'm a happy guy, really. I'm not an unhappy person.
No, no, you're
sure.
Right.
You look at me, you can see that I'm here. And I'm doing okay.
I know.
So the thing is that the world is not quite there. There's
right.
things going on in the world that people don't see.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of damage being done, and we don't see it. And that makes me a little heavy-hearted.
Right.
That it seems so hard. To get the message out, and it's so hard to actually, even with the technology we have today, it's so hard to get through the murk of the technology. I mean, I know this is a podcast,
yeah,
but you know, for listening to music, it's very degraded. It's less than 5% of what you heard on the Pono player.
But when you do stuff from, you know, all the way, you know, from the first record, you know, through Zuma, which is like, for some reason, that's like, out of all your records, I listen to Zuma a lot.
I was walking on Zuma this morning.
You were?
Yeah.
You listening to it?
No, just
the
walking.
Beach?
Yeah, listening to the ocean.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the seagulls.
But did you feel this pressing idea that there was something, some darkness afoot, you know, all your life? Not depression, but that, you know, the tone of what is unknown is somewhat menacing?
It's there.
Always been there.
You've got to, you know, recognize it.
Yeah.
You can't ignore it. It's just, you know, no fear,
yeah.
Love, no fear.
But did these fears, I guess what I'm trying to get at, that what people are afraid of, you know, that what you've sort of been through, you know, in your career, they were always sort of the same in the 60s.
You know, now it's what they're not afraid of that bothers me.
Like what?
Well, the what's going on in the climate, what's going on in the environment.
The thoughtlessness.
What we're doing
yeah.
to the world. The
right.
amount of animals
sure.
and living things that are just going away. We are not seeing what's going on. The insects are threatened. They have 10% of the fish in the ocean that we had when I wrote After the Gold Rush.
Yeah. Yeah.
We've lost 90%.
It's crazy.
But there's three times more of us than there were then. So, you know, you just got to look at it. Don't do the math.
We're doomed.
It's ugly.
We're doomed.
So, but no, we really, it's more than a word. It's
yeah.
more than something to say or to make a quick joke about. Not that you're joking about it, but people do.
Yeah.
That's what they do when they hear someone say something like this. It's like, oh you know,
what are you
God,
gonna do?
Neil is just, you know.
He's out there.
Yeah,
man.
He's out there. He, what is he looking at?
Crazy
you know,
old hippie.
I got this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, I got this stuff. It's going to make everything okay. So I say, break it out. Let's try it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Break out that stuff that can make it all good.
Yeah. There's an urgency to it. For you.
Yeah, there is.
For at least the past decade, a very specific urgency around war and seeds and, you know, people and pollution.
We just have to keep a record of a point of view, you know. That's what I'm trying to do. Keep a record of a point of view of what's going on, because this is the times these times in the history of what's going on in the world right now, they're going to be looking back at this.
Hopefully.
As, well, that was the, yeah, well, not in the too distant future.
Yeah.
But they'll be looking back at this going, wow, you know, during this time, so many things could have been done to keep what it is that we now only have pictures of.
Right.
And what we read about. But, you know, we'll see what happens. Mother Nature is incredibly strong. And
yeah, it'll adapt. We might not.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
We might not make it.
Yeah. Mother Nature will be fine. Yeah.
Actually, I think we're going to make it. I really do.
No, I do too.
I don't feel dark. I feel like Earth is just mistreated. And I think it's, you know, you just have to keep pointing it out and maybe people will want to make a change, you know, want to eat food that they know is cleaner and better for the earth. Study the way things are done.
Well, sadly, with humans, it seems it's something fairly catastrophic and very, you know, more than just a gradual erosion of climate or that something horrible has to happen that's tangible to most people all at once.
Yeah. You would think that something like Hurricane Sandy would have been that.
Not big enough.
No.
It was not as big
as...
And
even the biggest thing that happens.
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to say, you know, climate change is one of the great profit centers.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the way a lot of people look at it, like, that's going to be some good business coming out of that.
I think that's true. And I think that's disturbing, is that, like, you know, the free market can absorb and accommodate this, and there's going to be a big business in these environments that need to be created.
Yeah.
Where people can breathe. Imagine
nice.
The money.
Solar power. That would be so good.
That solar power would be easy.
It would be easy.
But that's not as big a business as enclosed cities. There's the big business, Neil.
That would be, wouldn't that? What an air conditioner that would have.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, you know.
Yeah.
I think it's going to work out one way or the other.
I do, too. Can we talk a little more about the old days?
Sure, whatever. I'm okay.
You're all right?
I'm in your garage.
Yeah, this is it.
Let's do what you want to do in here. It's nice.
Thank you, man.
It's a nice place, folks.
There's a lot of clutter
here.
There's
a lot of clutter in here. A lot of good books. There's the Something Doctrine, the School Doctrine by Naomi Klein right there.
Oh, that, yeah. Have you read that?
No, I haven't. You know, I'm not an avid reader.
That's the Shock Doctrine.
The Shock Doctrine.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. That's right up your alley, actually.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a lot of interesting things in here.
But when you did, and I know you've gone over this stuff before, but to track what you're saying, that, you know, this history of consciousness, when you were able to turn around the song Ohio to really actually, you know, come out in a short enough time that was relevant to the time that shit was happening, there was an urgency that you feel now that's the same back then.
If something happened and we wrote a song about it, there's no way it would come out.
Right.
It just nowhere to play it.
Oh, now.
Now.
Right.
Now you'd play it.
Right.
If you heard it.
But back then.
You might not know what happened.
Right.
Though, because it never would be on the radio. People wouldn't be talking about it because radio and TV and all the media and everything's all controlled by a certain amount of people and corporations. Before, it used to be many, many people doing this. But the Telecommunications Act in 1996 or something made it possible for corporations to own all the media. So it's six companies.
Well, but it's also fragmented. It's a divide and conquer media landscape. Back then, they were corporate owned, but there was only five of them. It was intimate. You know, it was always corporate owned, but at least like they were like on the pulse enough to go like, well, I think the kids like this music. And there were
people working for them that could make their own minds up.
That's right.
That was part of the way they did it. Those were the days when people could make their own decisions in the studio about what they were going to play. Now there's a format coming out of Philadelphia. It's coming out. It gets all the stations get it that subscribe to it. It's like could be like 300 stations all playing exactly the same thing.
No, and yeah, it's horrible.
You know, so that's it's.
You're like, in rotation on some of those stations.
It's programming. So. Yeah, it's programming. Yeah. I feel dizzy already from the rotation.
But at the time that you know you did the stuff with Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, and that there was a shifting of the guard. Like I think that what you speak to and what I'm experiencing as well is that nobody's on the same page really. Everyone can pick their own page, and it doesn't matter if the page is bullshit or not. But it seemed that somehow or another, you guys were able to get through because the corporations that were in charge of the music business wanted to sell records for kids, and you guys got out what you wanted to say.
Yeah, because kids were listening to the radio stations.
Right.
And then around the time of Woodstock,
yeah,
business realized, wow, there's a whole generation of people here. The 500,000 of them came to listen to these bands.
Yeah.
We got to start making commercials with bands in them.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and we got to get ourselves involved in
this. We got to sell out the 60s.
Yeah, we got to make this happen. We can use this energy. And
right.
That's what happened. And that's the way it goes, you know.
But those records that you continue to make that, you know, even, you know, after everyone knows there's another, after the Gold Rush Harvest, Time Fades Away, that these records that happened that were intimate records and that like later became, you know, these revered classics, you had already pulled away from collective consciousness in a way to do your own thing, right?
Well, you know, I wasn't thinking about it that way.
Well, you think
I
about that way now a little bit.
I just didn't want to do what I did before.
Yeah.
And I wanted to keep changing and trying things.
And the what they call, who gave it the name, the Ditch Trilogy?
Oh, I don't know. Somebody. Not me.
I know, right? Yeah. Does that bother you?
No. That's what it's for. You, if I can make things and put them out there,
yeah,
then it's up to other people to decide what they are. That's not what my job is not to decide.
Sure, you're the artist.
I just want to create it.
And what do you think that, you know, like an album like On the Beach and Tonight's the Night, or Tonight's the Night, that the story around that record was that it was very played all at once, right? It wasn't a lot of time you spent in the studio.
No.
And it was a direct reaction to the loss of your friend Danny, right?
Yeah, Danny and Bruce.
Both of them.
Yeah, two people.
And, you know, it was sort of, I think, a realization culturally at that time of you know, how horrible heroin was as well.
Well, yeah. And you know, Danny and Bruce were just two that I knew. I mean, you know.
Sure.
It's everybody. That's what it was about.
And at that time, that it was really all over the place, right? That was after the 60s, the crashing of the 60s.
There was a crash going on, yeah.
And
Hendrix, you know. So, you know, yeah, it's just real feelings. So these people were friends of mine. I worked with them and had great times with them and admired them.
And there was nothing you could do to stop them?
No.
That's the most fucked up thing about that
It's bad. So, you know, I reacted to it. And just like I'm reacting to things now. It's just
sure.
Same thing, the same guy,
yeah.
Same MO, same damn thing.
Yeah.
Nothing unpredictable about it at all. It's the same thing over and over and over again.
Right, in your heart. But, like, the only thing that's unpredictable is how you're going to handle it with your creativity, which is what you like to do.
Well, yeah, that's I don't know that either.
Right.
So, you know.
Yeah. You know what album I just got? Recently, I picked up the Rockabilly record.
Oh, that's a wild record.
It is, man.
Yeah.
I mean, that was, like, a sort of an interesting time there.
I did a record before that either. I don't know what it was.
Trans?
Yeah, and a guy from a record company said, Neil, why don't you just play some rock and roll, man? Why don't you just get, you know, just do your thing?
That guy.
Yeah.
And you just did your thing.
Yeah, I did.
And said, fuck you.
Here you go.
When you do something like that, that was sort of like, isn't that you paying a somewhat of a homage to what, you know, what you grew up with? I mean, isn't that there? You're
yeah,
like,
kind
it's
of.
Fun music to play,
kind of
right?
It was, yeah, yeah. I, you know, it was a culmination of things, you know, working on that one.
Yeah? What? Like what?
Well, I thought at that point in my life that, and I was still very young.
Yeah.
I said, well, here I'm walking down a hallway now, and I am in my painting period.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to do all these different, you know.
Yeah.
There's going to be different times.
Uh-huh.
Different characters and different pictures.
For like a few records, you mean?
Well, each record was a different one, and they're there.
Starting at like Reactor?
Somewhere, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
But you just said, why not just fucking explore it all and go into different
just,
beings?
I can do whatever I need to do now because it doesn't, you know, there's no sense in doing things over again.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of people doing things over and over again, and it didn't work for them.
No, because...
A lot of them didn't even live. I mean, they lost what it was they had.
Because the record company pressured to repeat themselves.
Whatever. I don't know if the record company or their own soul
fear.
Or their own manager or their wife or what.
Or fear.
I have no idea.
Sure.
And it may be that they just wanted to stay where they were because they succeeded. Any number of reasons to repeat yourself.
And you just never, they want nothing to do with that.
Well, I've been, like I said, in my own way, I've been doing the same thing over and over again for my whole life, which is just doing what I want to do.
Right, you know? But you have a voice. You have a, not the voice, but a, you are as
a point
a
of view.
Yeah.
I have a point of view, and it changes all the time, but it's mine.
That's right. But you know what it is? A style. Like, right. You know, there are certain, even if it's a note, even if you're doing something like, if I listen to trans, there's a melody there that I know is you.
Yeah, okay.
So you're a melody. What am I? It's not. It's point of view, but it's a tone. It's a Neil Young tone. Yeah,
there's something in there. I can still remember doing the trans stuff and having people boo me when I would do that. I'd put on the little microphone and sing through the machine with the vocoder, and we'd be playing somebody playing the melody that I'm singing, and I'm enunciating the words, and the melody's coming out of my mouth through the machine, kind of thing. It was like, and it was all based on my son not being able to talk.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, okay, I had a son who couldn't talk. Okay, he can't do anything. He can't move.
Yeah.
You know, so, yeah. You know, I was...
Trying to get through to him?
Oh, well, I was trying to represent what that must be like.
Right.
So I was trying to get through to the audience in a way where they knew that they couldn't understand what I was doing. That's just like my son trying to talk to me.
Yeah. And do you, like, over the years, like, I imagine, do you have a way of communicating with him?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. We're very... it's just... comes in the eyes and sounds, yeah, and body language.
And that's Zeke?
No, that's Ben. That's Ben, yeah.
Ben's the one who's...
Ben's a quadriplegic, yeah.
And he still travels with you everywhere?
Yes, he goes with me on the road as much as he can.
Yeah? And it's sort of he's your best audience, I'd imagine.
He's great. He's great. I just like to travel with him. He enjoys traveling.
Yeah.
You know, he's in a moving vehicle. And,
yeah.
You know, he's always in a wheelchair, you know, so just to be... jostled around in a moving vehicle and flying down the road. I mean, for him, it's a great experience.
And
he loves it.
And trans was sort of a way for you to try to understand?
A way for me to emulate what it must be like to be trying to talk and not have a voice, to be trying to communicate and not have what it is that people expected you to do.
Mm-hmm.
And you're still trying to get through, and that's what all that record is. I'm in that machine.
Yeah, yeah.
Trying to get out of the machine to get through, and... some people just were going, what the heck is going on?
Fuck them.
Yeah, they are. But I'm going, this is it. Here we are. This is good. You know?
And then, you know, two albums later, you do a country record. You know, I worked that shit out.
I like that.
I figured that out.
Yeah.
Now I'm moving on.
I've always loved music, and I like all kinds of music, and I have no... I'm not trying to be... what do you call it? Like, somebody said to me when I did that, well, you know, people, they don't trust you because, you know, they think you change styles.
And yeah.
It's like, so they can't believe you.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And I'm going, well, you know, that's okay.
Yeah.
They don't have to.
They'll get over it.
Yeah, either that or they won't, but yeah. I don't have to worry about it.
Let them go listen to the old records if they want to.
Yeah, or maybe one, three or four down the line. Who knows? Somebody will hit. Sometime bound to connect up with them again.
The experience of living with a kid that had that difficulty, like I don't know the pain or joy of that, but there must be not unlike your sort of open-mindedness around engaging animals and engaging the world and having fearlessness, there must be a some sort of understanding of Ben's joy that is something that you couldn't even access, that, you know, the way he feels things.
He's just a great human being, and I love him, and I know he loves me, and we enjoy a lot of things together. But he, you know, and he has so many things that we would consider to be hard things to deal with.
Right.
But that's the way he's always been.
Uh-huh.
So when I see people complaining about struggling to get something where they can't get it, I'm going, oh man, I think that, you know,
yeah.
I've seen people with a lot bigger problems.
In my family.
Yeah, yeah, you know, I've seen this, and, you know, so I just have another perspective on
it. And you have another son that has some problems as well?
Well, you know, he's got cerebral palsy, but he's a very, you know, he gets around great,
yeah,
and he's a very smart, very smart man.
Uh-huh.
And he's incredibly brilliant at the things he does.
And you have a daughter, too, that's an artist?
She's an artist, and she's great.
It's great.
Yeah.
A couple other things. It's hard because I know there's, like, so many huge Neil Young nerds out there, and, like, if I don't cover, you know...
You're never going to do that anyway. You'll never satisfy everybody.
I know. I can't.
Just do what you want to do yourself. You know, that's going
to
work.
Well, I'd like to know, like, about the film work as well, that, you know, working on Dead Man, which is a fucking masterpiece.
Isn't that a great movie?
It's a great movie.
I can't believe it.
And the soundtrack's amazing.
Oh, thank you. I told Jim Jarmusch, I said, Jim, this is a classic. You don't even need a soundtrack.
Right.
This could be a silent movie.
Yeah,
still a classic. You can't miss with this movie. This is a great movie.
Yeah.
And he said, well, I really want you to play on it, you know, so I did.
But what was amazing about it was that, you know, the instrument, like to really hear you, you know, like just space it out like that. Like it was a way that I had not heard you. You know, right. to where you're just, you know, honoring what's going on screen, but it's so clearly your shit, you know what I mean? But it wasn't, you know, all about, you know, what you were doing.
Yeah. I stood in a room about three times the size of this room with about 30 television sets. And they were all playing the movie, and I had all my instruments in there. It's maybe five times the size of this space. But I had all my instruments, and I just watched the movie, and we did it twice. And I just played all of that live.
Yeah.
We did it twice, and we ended up using the end of the first one and the beginning of the second one up to that, and that was the soundtrack for the whole thing.
And you've done other film work too. Demi works with you over and over again to do the concert movies.
Yeah, we did some of them.
And you did you do some with Dean Stockwell too?
We did Human Highway.
Oh yeah, I didn't see that. I need
to
see it.
You gotta check that one out.
Yeah?
Yeah, I recommend that one.
Yeah, I think
you'll enjoy that one.
You're still friends with him, right?
Who, Dean?
Yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. I love Dean.
You guys go way back. I love that you have these relationships.
Back to Topanga in the 60s.
But now that...
Pretty distant back there, but he was already a big success by the time I met him.
You know, yeah.
He was already rocking and rolling.
And what was his... What's the story on After the Gold Rush? It was based on a screenplay that he wrote?
A screenplay that he wrote with Herb Berman.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And you read it?
I read it and I wrote all the songs.
And it never got made?
And it never got made.
And here's another thing that I ended up doing this morning was that I saw Out of the Blue, the Dennis Hopper film.
Oh, man. That's a dark film.
Holy shit,
great
man.
Great film, though.
I saw it when it came out when I was in college in Boston. Yeah. And did you screen that movie before? Because they used a song in it.
Yeah, no. It's Dennis. Whatever you want to do.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You were friends with him, too?
Yeah.
He was an intense guy.
Very
real
art. That is a dark film.
I have not seen or heard of it in a long time.
Oh, it's a big, it's a classic.
It's a little, yeah. It's brutal and it's a classic.
Yeah.
Now, what if I can ask? Do your relationship with Willie Nelson? He's like, you know, he's a real country dude, and you guys are obviously pretty good friends, and you know, you have your hearts in a lot of the same places. Now, when you put together Farm Aid, when you got you and Mellencamp and Willie Nelson. That still goes on.
That's continuing on. Yeah,
and the fight now is mostly against genetic engineering, or what is the fight?
It's about educating people about the food that they eat and the choices that we have.
Yeah,
and the way that the earth is damaged by certain things. You know, this industrial farming is very bad for the earth.
Yeah,
it's not like good.
Yeah,
it's not what makes things go on forever.
It's not depleting.
It's very taxing on the planet, all of that stuff, the way they're doing it. But they own it. It doesn't make more food. That's a myth.
Yeah.
It's like we're not feeding the world. The world is basically, a lot of the world is starving, and we're not feeding the world with these chemicals. What they are doing is they're controlling things.
And subsidies as well, where you just like get all this stuff. If they're making cat litter out of corn, there's a problem. If there are people starving and they're making cat litter out of corn, somehow something's wrong.
There's a lot of things. There's a lot of things wrong. But it's the way it goes.
And what about performing, like with, there's something about performing, like, you know, what people call a garage band. You like to fucking play rock and roll. And you know, the there's something about performing live and performing as real and in the moment as possible on records that is what it's really about. That's always what it's been about.
Yeah, and this and Earth is a real representation of that.
Yeah,
that record really is. Really good bands, a really good band playing together.
Yeah.
Having a great time and improvising all the way through it.
Yeah. And what about with Pearl Jam? Did you like playing with those guys?
I loved playing with them. It was fun.
It's just like rock and roll, man, right?
Yeah.
And your guitar sound, like how long did it, and that's a dumb geek question, but you know, when did you arrive on that, man? Because that's another thing that stays pretty consistent. When you're playing electric guitar, I know it's you.
19. Well, you know, like the way it is now really started in the mid-70s.
Yeah.
But before that, I had the same guitar and the same amp. I just didn't put the gizmos in there.
Oh, yeah, yeah. To break it up, to make it, you know.
I just didn't add the other things to it and the motors and all that stuff that, you know.
Yeah. And, okay, two other records and we're done.
Is that all I got left? Two more records?
No. I think you're making... Somehow
it was like, who was that? Said, two more records and you're done.
I shouldn't have done that podcast.
Shit! Who was that?
Put the hex on me. Put the curse on me.
No, but the Greendale record, dealing with all of these issues that you find important, but making almost a stage play out of it and building it around a family and around the struggles of that. And was that totally conceived? Was that a one thing that you were thinking of?
Well, you know, all these projects kind of go together. That project is a lot like Tonight's the Night.
Yeah.
Because it was the same kind of a thing. It's a story. There's a thing in there.
Yeah.
And that I'm talking about all the way through it. And Greendale I wrote in my car on the way to the studio every day.
Mm-hmm.
I'd be...
What were you recording?
I was recording the song, the whole album.
Oh, so you're writing.
So every day I go to the studio, I drive across the ranch in my special deluxe Plymouth.
Yeah.
And I stop and I'd start writing the songs. And then when I couldn't think of anything more, I'd drive another 100 yards and stop again. New location, new information.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was pretty sure that where I was on the planet made a big difference to what I was getting.
Yeah.
So I tried to see, well, how far do I have to go, really? Very far, or is it, like miles, or is it feet? I had my writing tablet, and that's how I wrote every song on that album.
Uh-huh.
I would get up in the morning and play a few chords, and that would be the basis of the song, the first things that I played.
Yeah.
I wouldn't think about it. I'd just pick it up, and whatever happened, I'd just go, okay, I'm going to do that over and over again. That's the song. Then I'd write the words on the way over, and then we'd develop the song in the studio and finish it that night. That's how I did Greendale.
Yeah. And then the stage play was created
the story, because the story is told in the song.
Right. And Prairie Wind was a sort of a eulogy record, was it?
Prairie Wind was a unique record because it was... When I found out, I was in New York and we were doing something. I think I was supposed to go and be at the Hall of Fame in Canada or something.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting in the hotel and I had a couple of incidents with my vision.
Yeah.
And then I went to a doctor and they found a brain aneurysm.
Yeah.
And then they decided that, well, I'm going to have this taken out. And I said, well, okay, I have an operation on my brain. And they said, yeah, we're going to do that. And I said, well... we got a really good guy to do this.
Yeah.
When could we get in and do it, So it was like 8 or 9 days away.
Yeah.
So I went to Nashville.
Yeah.
I started taking the drugs that they gave me, which are like slowed me way down.
Yeah.
I went to Nashville and wrote and recorded Prairie Wind in Nashville during those 8 days.
So that was
it was like
a just in case
record. It could feel
like
a eulogy, but it just felt like I'd like to say a few things just in case.
Yeah.
One never knows.
Had your dad passed around that time as well?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was a lot going on.
Yeah,
mortality record.
Yeah, yeah.
It was
a passing study of it.
Yeah, yeah. The just in case record.
Yeah, kind of. But, it's a better late than never kind of record.
Right. Then not at all, too.
Yeah, really. I mean, I'm so far late is working for me.
Yeah, keep it late.
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you, outside of the songs and outside of working this stuff out, processing these emotions and music, do you occupy yourself with much of that mortality thought?
Not really. I mean, it creeps in every once in a while.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm 70.
Yeah.
So it's bound to creep in, once in a while. I see a little glimmer of light around my field of vision.
Sure.
Who's there? Who's there? Wait a minute.
I'm not ready. I'm not
Go
ready.
Go on. Get out of here.
I'm recording.
Get back in your box.
Exactly. That's why you keep working. You can't do it at work. I'm working.
Look, I'm looking at all your little gizmos on the floor down here.
I get those
for your guitar playing gizmos?
They give them to me. I don't
know. Are those plugins? Is that what they are? No, they're guitar plugins.
Yeah, those are effects boxes, and Earthquaker sends them to me, and I don't know what to do with them.
What they are? They're really the new digital version of the kind of shit that I had in my And I got all that stuff that I've got. I got old analog things.
Yeah, fuzz pedals and
yeah,
shit.
Yeah, even, you know, older, like original fuzz tones.
Yeah.
That don't have a pedal, but, you know, it's just the sound.
And, yeah, yeah.
And so I'm wired in and out of them, and I got it all wired into that thing on my...
Yeah.
That my I can hit with my feet. I got a whole bunch of selections, but I'm the only one who knows what they are because they're not labeled.
And they're not digital.
No, none of them are. They're all early.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, these are all new things that they send me. And I'm just a bedroom guitar player. You know, I'm just a hobbyist.
I mean, there's echo in there. There's a repeat.
There's phasers.
And I got analog tape machines running inside a box under my amp. And
you do?
It's always blowing up, and they bring out another one and fix the tape and everything. Yeah, it's great. Great.
Yeah,
it's a constant battle just to get through the show and have the amp hang in there. It's so fantastic. I mean, what a great relationship.
That's the excitement of it.
It
are we going to make it?
It is or not.
Yeah.
Or is the whole thing going to, is this the night it's going to like explode and catch on fire? My amp goes to 12.
Yeah, you got it.
It's not. It's a regular production amp.
Yeah.
I don't know how it happened.
Right.
You know, Spinal Tap.
The joke is the joke, but
I got my amp says 12.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm not even saying anything.
So that locks into it right there. That the way you approach life is exactly that, where it's sort of like, I don't know if it's going to make it through.
But I'm not sure.
Yeah,
I've heard these cars are great just before they blow up.
Yeah, exactly.
It's the motor sounds great. It never ran so good.
Yeah, and then it's over.
Boom.
Yeah, but that's the edge, man. That's the edge, right? It's nice to live there. That's where it feels alive.
I hope that, you know, it's a long cruise.
Yeah, it's going well. So what is the commitment to analog and the machinery? I mean, I'm with you on that.
Just the tone, man. Just the tone. It's the expression. It's real.
Mm-hmm.
It's real. It's the real deal. And
it's a relationship.
I grew up with that.
Right. The relationship with the equipment, not the illusion of the chip.
Chip is the replacement.
Mm-hmm.
It's the simulation.
Mm-hmm.
Everything's simulated, copied.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the original stuff is still rocks.
Yeah, it's the fucking shit.
Yeah, it is. And that's why, you know, the old, the vinyl of Earth sounds like God. It's amazing. But so does the high-res Pono version.
Yeah.
And the CD sounds pretty good. But other than that, I don't even sell it.
Yeah.
And I will say to your listeners,
because
this is a podcast.
Yeah.
If you want to get it, you know, if they, I think they play the whole album on Tidal in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Go on to Tidal and just record it off of Tidal.
Sure.
It's going to be 44.1.
Yeah.
So that way everybody can get it.
Ready?
Because I'm not selling that. I'm not selling the MP3.
Yeah, we're just about ready. We're going to do it. I'm going to have one more question.
When I start talking like that, my manager shows up.
He's nervous?
Yeah, he is. Hey, don't give it away. Hey, wait a minute. No, we want everybody to have it. I don't give a shit.
Dime.
Yeah, it's like
How long have you been with Elliot?
I can't sell that crap.
Somebody else
has to. You go make it yourself and take it home.
50 years.
50 years with that guy.
Not easy for him.
No, it's not easy for him either.
So I guess the in closing, Neil, are you a spiritual man? Do you consider yourself that?
I must be. I'm a maybe a pagan though.
Sure, that's all right.
And that's pretty good. I mean, I got nothing against God or anything.
Yeah.
I prefer to think of God as the Great Spirit.
Yeah.
Because I just don't like the pictures.
Yeah.
I don't like the pictures and the stories that much.
Yeah,
I don't subscribe to but I recognize everyone has a right to have a story that they can believe in that kind of organizes things for them, gives them something to relate to.
Uh-huh.
But I don't think people should profit off of that. I think that should be just something that
you have
out for
and
themselves.
That you can keep to yourself
or not. Yeah, right. You can do it yourself. But that's just my view.
All right. Well, I guess that's good. You feel all right about it?
I feel good.
Oh, did I do all right?
I think you did great. That list you got over there, I think you've covered, you know, at least three or four of the things on the list.
The last waltz. Well, that you did that. That was fun, right?
Yeah, yeah. For as far as I remember, it was great. I was up for 48 hours when I did that one. I was like, I got a little out of control. I started that day in Atlanta, Georgia.
Yeah.
And I did two shows.
Right.
Then I stayed up all night, and then I flew.
Doing the drugs?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was pretty shaky.
Yeah.
And then I got all, you know, that was probably one of the low points of the high points.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, people say that you're pretty fucked up. You look like you're having a good time.
I was doing all right. I was kind of grinding my jaw a little bit. It's kind of like on ice. It was not good.
And captured for posterity.
Yeah, right. Why not?
There it is.
That's what it looks like, folks.
Oh, well, you lived, man. A lot of, it's great that
the thing is, I didn't continue doing that. But
yeah.
That made a difference.
To the living.
Yeah.
Yeah, living, yeah, sure. Part, yeah, know. Definitely. Well, you know, the guys that, you know, like you and Clapton and Crosby and fucking Stills and, you know, a lot of the real warriors and great artists are still around. I know a lot of them are gone, but you guys all went pretty hard.
Yeah.
And you did
music
right.
Is good for you.
Thanks for talking, Neil.
All right.
Wow. Yeah, so that was me and Neil Young. It was one of those interviews where it happens a lot with the giants, the music, the heroes, where I get a little like, oh my God, I'm talking to Neil Young, and yeah, I was nervous about it, and that happens to me after the interview. I was like, oh, how did that go? Was that okay? And a friend of mine, I'll just share the story with you. A buddy of mine was at a family get together, and he was talking to someone who was on set for a Dan Rather interview that happened at Neil Young's house the afternoon of the day that he came to my house. And apparently they were like setting up lights and stuff when Neil got there. And Dan Rather was just, you know, trying to make small talk with him to pass the time. And he asked him what he'd been doing today. And I guess Neil said, I just had this great interview. Some guy named Mark. We did it in his garage. And apparently, Dan Rather asked him what made it great. And Neil said he was fearless. He wasn't afraid to fail. He didn't need to know all the answers. And so we actually had a conversation. I wouldn't even call it an interview. Neil Young said that. And I got to be honest, it's the best praise I could get. Because I barely call myself an interviewer. I call them talks. Go to WTFpod.com for all the WTF Pod stuff. You can go to WTFpod.com/tour for my dates that are coming up. What else? Let's play some guitar a little bit for Neil. Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here, and when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.